Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories that I'll be looking into on today's programme. Pope Benedict XVI made a one-day pastoral visit to the city of Naples that coincided with the opening of an international peace forum attended by religious leaders and representatives of all the major faith traditions. And we shine the spotlight on the increasingly crucial role played by fishermen in saving illegal migrants at risk of drowning at sea, and find out why an ongoing trial in Italy may make them more reluctant to save lives. Pope Benedict made a one-day pastoral visit to the southern Italian city of Naples on Sunday, during which he celebrated an open-air mass and visited the cathedral which houses the relics of the city's patron saint. His visit also coincided with the opening of a three-day international peace forum on the theme of A World Without Violence, organised by the Catholic lay association Sant'Egidio. Religious leaders and representatives of all the major faith traditions are attending the forum. Philippa Hitchin is there in Naples and she picks up the story.
Pope Benedict's day in Naples began with Mass attended by the Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi and tens of thousands of people from across the Campania region, during which he called for very practical solutions to combat the powerful organised crime network here, the Camorra. The visit ended with a moment of private prayer at the tomb of Naples' patron saint, San Gennaro, to whom people have a strikingly strong devotion despite all the difficulties they face. In his homily at the Mass, the Pope listed many of those difficulties: the widespread poverty, the lack of jobs and decent housing, which leave little hope for the future.
Napoli ha certo bisogno di adeguati interventi politici, ma prima ancora di un profondo rinnovamento spirituale.
Naples needs adequate political initiatives to combat these problems, the Pope said, but above all, it needs a profound spiritual renewal and a formation of consciences which can transform people's attitudes and ways of behaving. The key to this transformation, the Pope said, is prayer, the deepest expression of faith. Among those listening to his words, huddled under umbrellas to keep out the rain, were impoverished immigrants from the surrounding region, prisoners from local jails, and thousands who had flocked to the city centre from the sprawling suburbs where drug addiction, gang warfare, and lack of opportunities for young people make fertile ground for the ruthless crime bosses. Yet his denunciation of this widespread culture of violence and his call for better education and employment opportunities was not just a message of support for the church here in Naples, on the front line in the fight against the Camorra. In many respects, the political and social problems facing this city are reflected in deprived areas of towns and cities all across the wealthier nations, as well as in the developing world. Amongst those listening to the Pope's words were religious and political leaders from countries across the globe, as well as heads of organizations working for justice and peace. Sylvie Boucari de Pontoile is president of FIACAT, the International Federation of Christians for the Abolition of Torture.
All my life is dedicated to the struggle against violence, especially the most cruel violence, which is torture. And I know that there are so many things happen in this city, which is so violent. So I am very touched by what he says about the young people, how we have to do with young people to educate them and then to give some occupation to prevent them to go to violence. it's quite a new thing in this type of discourse of the Pope. So it's very interesting, and I would like that everybody listen to that and to apply it, of course, in real life.
He's going beyond words, in other words, calling for very practical action. He was speaking, of course, to the Italian Prime Minister and many other regional officials who were here attending that Mass.
Of course, he appeals to them to do many things, but not only to them. I'm very interested that he called to every people, where they are, in the offices, in schools, in everywhere. So the struggle against violence, what he says, is the job of everybody, in fact. Not only the responsible, not only all the people, but all the society.
Your organisation, of course, mobilises Christians, particularly from all over the world, to fight against violence and the abuse of human rights. It's the same aims as this St. Egidio community meeting this year for a world without violence. What do you think can really be achieved at a meeting of this kind?
I think it's very important, because the people who are responsible in each religion are using to meet each other each year. They know more and more, and then they can work together. They don't pray only together, but during the year after the meeting, they can work together. And for me, it's also very important, because the prayer and the action are, in fact, so gathered, you know, to do something, to go to better humanity. And for that, Saint Egidio is leading the road to that.
Do you think that religious leaders could and should be much more effective in trying to find practical ways of bringing people together across religious divides?
I think so, because we can see the gospel, we can read the gospel and the life of Jesus Christ. In fact, Jesus prays, Jesus speaks, but Jesus do also. And it's very important, and it's quite new, because religious leaders used to speak very often, but they don't do something so many times. And perhaps if they just call to everybody to do, but also to act, and they act themselves, perhaps this way encourage everybody to do in his or her job, or in the school, or in the offices, or in every association, in every engagement, then people will go in that way.
What would be your message then to all these Christian leaders, so many of them, Catholics, Protestant, Orthodox, all gathered here in Naples? What would you like to say to them?
I would like to say that I call to them to unit, to make a declaration, a general declaration against torture. Torture is the worst thing a human being can do on other human being, because it's a volunteer violence against another people. And I would like that they gather to say to the world that it's awful, that it's the contrary of the human dignity. But together, it's a sort of a great signal to the rest of the world.
From the problems of violence in the city of Naples, Pope Benedict went on to condemn the violence which rages in so many parts of the world, and where the name of God is still used to justify conflict and aggression. Addressing the heads of all the different religious delegations gathered at the seminary in Naples, the Pope reiterated that religions must never be exploited to promote hatred and violence. Instead, he said, religions can and must offer precious resources for the construction of a peaceful future for humanity.
La strada del dialogo per favorire l'intesa fra le diverse culture.
The Catholic Church, Pope Benedict said, intends to continue following the path of dialogue to encourage understanding between different cultures and religious traditions. He prayed that this spirit of dialogue, begun by his predecessor, Pope John Paul, at the first interreligious meeting of prayer for peace in Assisi, will be spread especially in those areas of the world where tensions prevail, where freedoms are denied, and where men and women suffer the consequences of intolerance and incomprehension.
One of the religious leaders attending the International Peace Forum in Naples was the primate of the Anglican Communion, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, who spoke to Philippa.
The Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, has just returned from what he describes as a harrowing visit to the Middle East. In Syria, he met with refugees fleeing the violence in Iraq, and in Lebanon, he talked with Palestinian refugees who have lived all their lives in overcrowded camps.
The meeting with the Iraqi refugees was in the context of a Syrian Orthodox settlement not far from Damascus. The stories we heard were dreadful stories, stories about systematic targeted brutality and slaughter of the most distressing kind. I've used the term ethnic cleansing about what some extremist groups are trying to do in Iraq, and I don't apologize for that. I think that's exactly what's happening. We hear stories of abductions, and of course in the last week we've had the two abductions of Chaldean priests in Iraq. We heard stories of murder and repeated death threats, people being driven away from their homes by threats of assassination, by actual attacks, people not knowing what had happened to sons and daughters who'd been abducted. And we met, I suppose, about 300 refugees that afternoon. We couldn't begin to listen to all the stories, but I suppose we heard several dozen such stories, enough to give us a flavour of the huge scale of the problem that's now there. Syria itself is buckling under the strain of looking after a million plus Iraqi refugees, and they, of course, have begun to close their borders more regularly, begun to impose stricter visa controls. That in itself is impacting on this refugee community. The day after, when I went to visit one of the Palestinian camps near Beirut, I met people who'd been there for 58 or so years, who'd come there as children and grown into adulthood there in the camp. I met children of 5 and 6 who were starting their lives in the camp with very little feeling that they'd ever be out of it. And there again, a community just practically and materially very much stretched and under-resourced, with one part-time physician in effect coming in a day and a half a week, no proper perinatal care. What is extraordinary is, in that particular camp, what a level of positive, active initiative there is among people there. So it was a period of 2 days when I realized, perhaps more fully than I ever had before, that in the Middle East at the moment we have quite simply an unprecedented refugee problem. Not probably since 1945 have we seen so concentrated a problem of displaced persons. Now, in the aftermath of the Second World War, displaced persons were part of the geography of Europe and indeed the Mediterranean world. We're now rapidly reproducing that in a far more inflamed, embittered context. The presence of these refugee communities is a constant irritant, a source of resentment, fear and despair in a region which already has more than its share of those things. And I dread to think what the impact could be of renewed cycles of violence in the region, whether it's another cycle of violence in Lebanon, whether it's some foolish and ill-thought-out attack by a Western power on one of these countries. It'll simply inflame a problem which is already spiralling out of control.
You met also, didn't you, with a wide range of the Muslim and Christian leaders in Syria and Lebanon. What else really can they, if anything, particularly the Christian leaders there, what else can they really do to try and help these people and to try and ease the tensions that are still there?
The historic Christian communities in Syria and Lebanon, of course, have a long, long history of living constructively, patiently alongside Muslim neighbours. And what they all feel, I think, is that they are being slowly squeezed out of the geopolitics, slowly marginalised in their own historic homelands, and so they feel perhaps more powerless than ever, more vulnerable, because they're identified with the West in some people's eyes. That being said, I think they achieve extraordinary things in refugee care particularly. In terms of political leverage, of course, they have very, very little, even in Lebanon, where the Maronite community is smaller than it was. The overall Christian population is now probably less than half because of mass immigration.
But what contribution can religious leaders and people of all faiths make to prevent violence and conflict? That was the question posed by the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, spiritual head of the Orthodox communities worldwide, at the official opening of this three-day peace forum on Sunday evening. Gathered in the famous San Carlo Opera House with its lavish red and gold interiors, participants listened to the founder of the Saint Egidio community, Andrea Riccardi, as he challenged them to overcome the culture of fear which has infiltrated politics and is now used to justify violence against those perceived as different and thus a threat to our way of life. Among the most powerful witnesses of political violence at that opening session was U Utara, a monk from Burma who lives in exile in London but is regularly in contact with the Buddhist monks whose peaceful demonstrations were brutally repressed by the military during the recent pro-democracy demonstrations.
A lot of people are angry by the military government because they try to destroy Buddhism, especially religion. They not respect Buddhism. They never think the military general will shoot Buddhism. Reality is they shoot Buddhism peaceful demonstration.
And it was really that shooting of the monks, wasn't it, that brought international attention to the crisis there. Tell us a bit about the role that Buddhist monks play in Burmese society.
Yeah, Buddhism is very important for our country because the majority, 90% of people are Buddhist. So Buddhism is a very important role in our country. The Buddhism lead for our independent colony.
Independence from Britain.
Britain, yeah.
Are you in contact with many of the monks there in Burma? Do you know how many of them perhaps were arrested? How many of them were sent to labor camps?
Yeah, we cannot count them because, example, 500 monastery Buddhism who study in the monastery, only 3 or 4 Buddhism only just stay in there. But other Buddhists disappear or were missing. And government, they no announce. I expect more than 2,000 Buddhist men were missing or is dead or in prison.
They're still missing?
Still missing.
2,000 of them?
More than 2,000.
Were you disappointed that the international community, that other countries around the world, were not able to put more pressure on the military government to stop this repression?
Yeah, I am really disappointed because before 20 years ago, in 1988, democracy uprising, the world doesn't know what's happened in Burma. But now the media is very advanced. They show the world what's happened in Burma. So I think we need more pressure to the military government. If an international community cannot tell or cannot help, Burma is more suffering than before.
And that report came from Philippa Hitchin in Naples.
Ave Maria, stella del mare, tu sei madre gloriosa di...
7 Tunisian fishermen who say they rescued 44 migrants at sea are on trial in Italy for aiding and abetting illegal immigration. If convicted, they face up to 15 years in jail. The case has alarmed human rights groups, who say the Tunisians should be thanked, not put on trial, for saving people. They fear conviction would discourage fishermen from rescuing drowning migrants. With thousands of illegal immigrants setting off each week in rickety, overcrowded boats to reach Europe, fishermen play an increasingly crucial role as potential lifesavers. The migrants, who come from many different countries in Africa, the Middle East and Asia, are all hoping to find a better life in the wealthy countries of Europe. But how many of them never reach their destination and instead perish at sea? Fortress Europe, an Italian website that monitors deaths and disappearances of migrants in Europe, says there have been nearly 500 reported deaths in the Strait of Sicily alone so far this year, and many fear that these figures could be just the tip of the iceberg. When a flimsy boat capsizes due to rough seas and overcrowding, or the engine cuts out, often the migrants' only chance of survival is to hope that a fishing boat may spot them in the waters and come to their rescue. That's why human rights groups and refugee advocacy groups are concerned about this ongoing trial involving the 7 Tunisian men. They were arrested in August after they brought 44 people, including two pregnant women and a disabled child, ashore to the Italian island of Lampedusa. The Tunisians spent more than a month in jail before being brought to trial in Sicily. Andrew Galea de Bono is a lawyer and an international advocacy coordinator for Jesuit Refugee Services. He fears this particular case could definitely discourage fishing boats from rescuing migrants at risk of drowning.
So far, there have never been any convictions on a case of this sort, and the reason is that there is an attempt by the law to encourage humanitarian actions, to encourage people to save others who are in danger at sea. It is actually international law and Italian law that people should and must rescue people who are in danger of drowning at sea, so they are obliged to do that. Therefore, it will be bad and quite confusing as well for potential rescuers to be found in a situation where they are also potentially liable to up to 15 years in prison for doing something which the law also tells them to do.
So in a sense, there's a fundamental contradiction here.
Yes. On one side, we are telling people you should rescue people in danger. And on the other hand, we're saying if you rescue people in danger, you can end up in jail. You are potentially a criminal. And so therefore, potential rescuers ask themselves in a moment of hesitation, which can cost lives, they ask themselves, shall we rescue or shall we not? And even when eventually rescuers, fishermen who rescue people, are not found guilty, they still do undergo trial and sometimes have their fishing boat confiscated for up to a week or more, which means that they can't work in those days, and which leads to situations where potential rescuers do not rescue people and people die. And that's a consequence. I mean, people are dying due to hesitations caused by wrong priorities.
In fact, you mentioned there about them having their boats impounded and being detained. The seven Tunisian men who are on trial in this particular case, they were held for more than a month in jail. So, as you say, even if they are eventually found innocent, their livelihood has obviously been badly hit by this lengthy detention.
Yes, this unfortunately is already going to create a precedent whether the people are released or not. Therefore, anybody who's going to find themselves in a similar situation to these seven Tunisian men are going to rightly pose themselves questions. How much is this going to affect our lives? Is it worth for ourselves calling coast guards to help these people when it might compromise our own lives?
How crucial a role do fishermen play in saving migrants at sea? Because as we know, these migrants are often set forth in very overcrowded and rickety and basically often unseaworthy boats.
It's very random. Basically, the fishermen have quite a big possibility of encountering boats going from south to north because there are quite a few and quite widespread around the sea. So they do obviously play a role in this, but it's not just fishermen, but also other private boats have in the past been part of rescue operations. We've had a case of Spanish ships carrying merchandise, for example, coming across people who are drowning, and they might well find themselves in a similar situation to fishermen. But yes, I mean, these private boats definitely play a potentially big part in rescuing people because they find themselves in very cut-off places in the middle of the sea where it's either them who rescue the people or the people drown. It's not as if it's a rescue operation on land where the people can sit and wait. If the sea is rough, and even if it's not, people have to struggle to stay afloat, and it takes time for the so-called official rescue teams to come and support this rescue mission. So it's very important that private boats are encouraged to keep on rescuing people.
And when it comes to JRS, have the staff there said that in their talks with migrants when they've reached, shall we say, their host country, have they told of tales where they have been rescued by fishermen or other operators of private vessels?
It is very common for people who eventually reach a country of protection to have benefited from a rescue operation, even from non-official parties. Mainly the people who do end up getting caught and seeking asylum are people who find themselves first rescued and then detained sometimes for long periods of time, in the case of Malta. So it's not uncommon for people to tell us stories of being rescued at sea, yes. And sometimes, tragically, they also tell us stories that they were rescued, but some of their companions on the travel were not as lucky. Sometimes even relatives die on the journey. Quite tragic stories, actually. And it just makes you understand how many people are actually not managing to make it across the Mediterranean.
In fact, do we have any approximate idea how many migrants have drowned making the sea crossing from Africa or the Middle East to Europe?
Unofficial figures state that since 1988, over 10,000 people have died. The official figure at the moment is 10,372 people, and these are the ones who have been ascertained. Amongst them, over 3,500 are missing at sea. So we're talking about quite a huge number of people who are known to have died or have been missing for quite a number of years and are obviously thought to be dead. But the figures definitely could be much, much larger than that.
So these estimates or semi-official figures could just be the tip of the iceberg?
Probably they are, yes. When you find a body floating alone, it's probably likely that there were at least another 10 people with that person who drowned, just that their bodies were never found.
How often does it happen that bodies do wash up on the shores of the Mediterranean?
Very often, every week, sometimes every day of the week, especially in the summertime when more trips are made. I mean, if you go and look on some of websites which do document the deaths at sea, you'd be shocked to see how many.
Are there other cases where the migrants tell of fishermen who, instead of rescue them, turn their backs on migrants in difficulty?
We have come across at least a couple of cases where it was eventually found out that a fisherman has not rescued someone at sea due to fear. I mean, there was the famous case just a couple of months ago in Malta where a Maltese fisherman found some people floating, clinging onto a tuna net in the middle of the sea, and the person refused to take them aboard, claiming that he was afraid of what would happen to him, and he just went off. I mean, fortunately, some of the people survived. Unfortunately, some others died. I feel that there are more people who are rescuing than not rescuing at the moment, but the more time passes and the more restrictions are being made on people to rescue, and the more the possibilities of their boats being impounded and then being prosecuted, the more we're hearing of stories of people, of fishermen who are, at the end of the day, deciding not to rescue people.
Given this issue and given, as you say, these increasing restrictions or fears that may be felt now by fishermen and other vessels before they pick up illegal migrants, what move would you like to be seen taken by governments, the governments of the countries concerned?
We have to understand that there are not going to be any clear-cut solutions to this situation, and therefore we've got to prioritize what we can do and what we're ready to do. We have to ask ourselves this question: as Europeans, are we really ready to lower our value that we give to human life in order to stop people from coming to Europe? And this is the fundamental question. We have a priority to make. Is it going to be human lives, or is it going to be some notion of security which is being imposed on us as human beings? What are we going to choose, life or death? And it's as simple as that.
I was speaking there to Andrew Galea de Bono, lawyer and international advocacy coordinator for Jesuit Refugee Services.
Ave Maria, stella del mare.
And that's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And this programming note for our Rome listeners: starting on October the 28th, this programme will no longer be broadcast on 105 FM, but you can still catch it on the same days at the same times on 93.3 FM. You can also find our programmes, of course, on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.